Hello, I'm Dahlia.
And I'm Alma. This is Nightmare on Fifth Street, a horror movie podcast.
Okay, everybody. I'm so excited about I always say that I'm so excited, but I am. Every movie I'm excited to talk about. Yeah, but definitely. Yeah, Coco di Coco da. It is a Swedish flick. I like saying flick too. But right now, I'm sure if you've seen the movie, you're yelling at me right now. No, it's Coco di Coco day. Because they do. They're singing the little nursery rhyme in the beginning, Coco di Coco day. But did you know that this nursery rhyme is actually sung in many languages in different countries, but it's originally a French nursery rhyme. And in French, it is said Coco di Coco da. So I'm going to continue saying Coco di Coco da.
Ooh, I learned something. Yes, because we did note it when we were listening to them singing the song that we thought we said it incorrectly. Cool.
Correct. But I was trying to justify my pronunciation. No, I'm just kidding. That's not what I went looking for. It just happened to be I was looking for this nursery rhyme, and it is based off this French nursery round. I love rounds. Rounds are my jam. Right? They were always so fun in school.
Yes, that's what we did on buses, bus trips, and like vacations. We didn't have stuff, man.
Yeah. I won't say it in French because I used to have a beautiful French accent when I was taking French and when I used to practice my French with my French friends. Say that 10 times fast. But anyways, it is The Rooster is Dead. That's the nursery rhyme.
Let's get started depressing everyone.
All right, Alma, who made this movie? Who wrote it? Who directed? Who's in it?
This movie was written and directed by Johan Nyholm. I apologize if I pronounced that incorrectly. We do have a few key players, but I didn't want to mess up the pronunciation of those as well. But it's a very small cast.
So do we want to just get into talking about it?
Let's do it.
I just want to say real quick, if you are listening to this episode, you have most likely watched the movie already. However, if you have not, and you just like to hear our rendition of the movie, I do want to warn you, trigger warning, content warning, there is child death. Now, while it is a brief scene, incident in the movie, it is actually the catalyst for the entire rest of the movie for the mother and father. So I did want to say that. All right, let's get to it. The beginning of the movie starts off with this, oh my God, I hate saying creepy trio, but they were kind of a creepy trio. And they're like all walking and shit, and they're whistling and singing that nursery rhyme that I just mentioned. And I'm not going to sing it because, first of all, I'm going to fuck it up. Secondly, I don't know. You know how there's like fair rights or all that shit to like nursery rhymes, but I don't want to mess with that just in case we're going to get dinged for that. But yeah, I really enjoyed this song, actually. Like I said, it was creepy, but I liked it. So it starts with the little girl after we see this creepy trio walking and singing and whistling to this song. Completely separate, there is a little girl in a store shop window, and she's just staring at this music box, and she is completely entranced by this music box. It's singing the song that we saw the trio in the beginning singing. Well, it's not singing it, but it's playing the music of it. On the music box decoration is painted that trio, which was a man that is wearing like a white, I think they're called bowler hats. I don't know. I'm really bad with hats. But he's wearing all white in this little hat. And then this, I want to start saying now, this stunning, beautiful woman that I love the way she's dressed. She's dressed completely in black and her hair is just like fantastical. And then this big, big lumberjack of a man. So those three are going to be, we're going to reference them again later, but it started off with them. And then they're very cutely painted onto this music box. Did you like that introduction, Alma? How it went from showing them to them being painted onto the music box and then the little girl?
I was trying to guess the tone of the movie based on the intro because Dahlia and I didn't look up the film before we watched it. I didn't. Did you, Dahlia?
Honestly, I didn't because I've heard a lot about it as far as like, it's really good. But sometimes I do like going into a movie knowing nothing about it, because that way outside opinions don't taint it.
Exactly. I headed into it and I thought I was going to try to guess right away because I'm annoying that way. What kind of movie is it? Is it a ghost movie? Is it a monster movie? And I know I was saying that and shouting it out because I'm annoying like that.
You're not annoying. It was funny.
I was like, so it kind of gave this folk movie kind of vibe
that
to
it.
Like, I was thinking Wicker Man, like the original Wicker Man or something, okay. Or mm-hmm. Midsummer, like a folk movie. So
you
I
were
was
describing
to say,
it perfectly, yeah.
Oh, okay. So that's what I was thinking based on the music and the people and then the little music box. I was like, whimsical. Let's do this.
So next we see the little girl with her mom and dad. And they just dote on her. Her name is Maya. And I'm sure they say in the movie because it's her birthday, but I don't know, maybe at most 8 years old. So I'm sure they're making this big event out of it. And they are, at first I thought it was like a family reunion going on. I think I may have even said it out loud several times. Oh, it's a family reunion. It's a family reunion. But I think it was just maybe a vacation spot, kind of like a tourist spot. So they're like wearing like bunny paint. They're wearing bunny paint.
Did they squeeze bunnies to get that paint from them?
Shut up. They're wearing
paint.
Don't
do podcasts with your sisters.
They're wearing, I don't even know how to say it now. They're wearing paint on their faces. They're
face paint.
It's face paint. Sorry.
You're killing me.
It's face painted. They're supposed to look like bunnies. There, I said it. So again, they love their daughter. They're spoiling her everything. And they're at this fun restaurant. It's, I don't know if it's a themed restaurant or not. So they're having lots of fun. It's her birthday. And you notice that she's holding something the whole time that's wrapped up like a present. And when you look at it, it's obvious it's the music box, because if you saw the music box in the beginning, it's wrapped in tissue paper and it's the shape of the music box. So I think it's kind of cute that she was obviously looking at this music box and loved it. And her parents bought it for her and then wrapped it for her so that she can open it on her birthday. It was just adorable.
Yeah, I thought that was really sweet when you pointed it out to me, because I kept asking what the present was.
You did.
And yes. And you were like, it's the music box. Duh.
So yeah, they do the whole thing, dinner and everything. But then all of a sudden, the mom gets sick. And, you know, she gets sick. I'm not going to go into detail there. So we're starting to think, oh, is this going to put a damper on kind of like the festivities and all that? But turns out she's allergic to what she just ate. And what was it that she ate? It was shellfish, I think it was, or mussels. That's what it was.
Mussels. Yeah.
Yeah, they call, like, I guess it was ambulance, because she's there sitting either with a nurse or EMT, and they're treating her. And she's like, but I've eaten mussels before. So the lady explains to her that sometimes you can develop an allergy later in life after you've had something, you know, several times. And I will say that is true. I am not allergic to, knock on wood, that I know of, food. However, I developed allergies later in life, so that, you know, growing up in South Texas, I was always fine with the cedar, the mold, everything. But now it's like, fuck it. I'm dead during allergy season.
I was going to bring up the time that we went to the beach and we were having a sister's trip out there. I woke up with my lips all swollen up and tongue.
I remember.
And I had it itchy, and I was like, I feel like I'm having trouble breathing. And my cheeks, and I had the hives all over my body. Remember? I took a picture.
Yes.
We thought it was hilarious. You guys were making jokes and we were having such a good time. And then you had to take me to the urgent care to go get a shot because I was having an allergic reaction to something. And it wasn't until I think the second time I had to go get a shot that the doctor said, what are you putting on your lips? And I said, well, my lips have been real burning and I keep putting on chapstick. It's like, your lips are tingling and burning. What are you putting on your lips? And I said, it was the beeswax chapstick. And he's like, I think you're allergic to beeswax. But I didn't know that. That had never been a thing. And I had been using that chapstick for years. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's immediately when I stopped using it, no more lips swelling up and no more allergic reactions.
I think the reason we were laughing and making fun, because it looked like you had gotten fillers. You were the lip fillers.
Yes, the top lip had turned inside out, but it didn't look cute. It looked like I got filler somewhere that was like back alley or something, because it was real bumpy, the bottom one. But they were huge. They were huge. It was so funny. But it was like not attractive.
Sorry, my teeth.
But also, I do recall that Daisy kept saying, "You better not ruin our vacation."
Oh, and yes.
After that shot, if you're not good to go, we're not taking you anywhere.
We did. But if something was really wrong with you, we would take care of you for real.
You did get me to the emergency room or something like that.
Okay, so I already lost my place. Oh, yeah, that's right. So the mom's face is swollen in her, and she's got, I think maybe even her hands. I can't remember. But anyways, now we see it very clearly on her face. Before it was just, we just thought it was like a little, you know, GI problems. But now it's like, oh, no, she's obviously allergic to those muscles. So off they go into a fucking helicopter. She gets airlifted out of there to go to the hospital. That was adventure.
That's cool. Oh,
not only did she get air-evac'd, but the whole family got on that helicopter, which I thought was interesting, because here when we air-evac people, we don't put the whole fucking family on there. It's just the person that needs the medical attention.
And you know what's interesting is I wrote down helicopter ride. How fun. I didn't even put two and two together. They're going because it's an emergency. And I was thinking, what a family adventure.
Oh my God, Alma, you're going to make me, my cheeks hurt so bad by the end of this. Okay, so here's a little foreshadowing though. While they're talking, while she's talking to the medical personnel, the mom, she mentions, oh, but my daughter had the muscles too. And they kind of brushed it off and say, oh, well, she seems fine, because the little girl was not having any kind of allergic reaction like the mom was. So mom didn't bring it back up, and the healthcare professionals kind of, you know, swept it aside again because they didn't see the little girl having any problems. So now we are in, here's another one. They're all three staying in the hospital room together. All three of them. Like there's like a bed for all, no, there was two beds in there. That's right. Because the mom and dad were sharing a bed, and the little girl had her own bed. There's a fucking hospital. Is that how it is in Sweden? Do we have any Swedish listeners? Please tell me. Is that the, your healthcare system over there? Because I thought that was fucking amazing. It was like a hotel room, but it was the hospital.
Nobody even got to stay with me when I was in the hospital many times. I've been so many times, and nobody ever gets to stay with me. I want a guest. It's lonely there. I'm bored. Give me somebody to hang out with. Well, there was that time, Dahlia, that I gave birth, and they thought you were my girlfriend, and you got to stay with me and have a romantic dinner. That was really nice.
True fucking story. I came from Portugal to Texas to be there with Alma when she had one of her children. And I was in charge, and I loved being trusted with this. Alma was not going to be able to be with the baby right away.
I had Dahlia in charge of making sure that they didn't take my baby. I wanted to make sure that the baby I sent off was the baby they brought back to me. Right. Okay. Anyway, go on, Dahlia.
That was great. But yeah, anyways, so yeah, I know they thought we were a couple because I was with the baby. They never asked my relation to the baby. I was with them. I was holding them. I was like, don't you come near this baby. I was practically telling people not to come near that baby. And then when you have a baby in the hospital, sometimes they give you a special meal. And I got to have, it's supposed to be for the partner and the woman that just gave birth. And I got to have the special meal with my sister.
She called it an intimate or a romantic dinner. One of the two. And I was like, she thinks you're my girlfriend. Cool. Yes, we will take two of those dinners.
I was like, fine, that's okay.
And the sparkling wine, please. Thank you.
Thank you. A little bit more. Okay, so I don't see. Oh, yeah, that's right. We're talking about the Swedish healthcare system, which seems amazing. So they wake up the next morning after they had been medevaced in, and now it's the little girl's birthday because it was her birthday weekend. You know how everybody does birthday weekend or birthday week now? That's what they were doing for Maya. So they're like trying to be quiet, but like the mom trips over something, makes a little noise, and dad makes a little noise over here, and they're like, oh, cry, because they want to surprise her with the cake. So I can't remember if it was a cake or a cupcake, but they put a little candle in it, they lit it, and then they start singing happy birthday as they're coming over to her, and she's like, the little girl isn't waking up. And they're like, come on, wake up, Maya. It's your birthday. Unfortunately, Maya did not wake up. Maya passed away right there. And it was heart-wrenching scene. It really was. Apparently, she had passed away during the night. And remember how I told you guys earlier that mom mentioned that the little girl had also eaten the mussels? I'm thinking that we're supposed to think that the little girl also had a very bad reaction to the mussels and passed away from them. And it is a horrifying scene for me. I don't know, because I'm a parent. I don't know, or as a human.
They set up such a beautiful family relationship at mm-hmm. the beginning of the movie. And now it's the loss of their daughter. And an interesting point is that we have two movies in a row that we've covered with this kind of sad, right. huge plot point.
What is wrong with us?
Yeah. I'm like, I think we need to do an Aliens movie next or something that way.
Right? We're gonna find the one alien movie where it's alien babies and something happens to the alien baby. Oh,
yeah. 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 Maybe we'll do a little bit more research before our next movie so that way it's not such a bummer. Sorry, guys.
Right. Well, see, it happens because I don't look up what's going on in the movie. But anyway, but this is the catalyst for the rest of the movie, because what ends up happening is that obviously the mom and the dad, well, not obviously, but the mom and the dad go on with life. I think it's like 3 years later, and their relationship is strained now. We see the dad who's trying to stay kind of like, I don't know, like he's trying to have a sense of humor, trying to play around. I think maybe for the past 3 years, maybe that's what he's been trying to do with the mom, but she is, you know, I don't blame her. She's very morose. She's always in a bad mood, and that's okay. I mean, she's trying to, I can't imagine. It's only 3 years later that she lost her child. So she's not having any of his foolishness though. So they're going off to a camping trip, and she is like just kind of picking fights with him, and he's trying to make it a fun thing. Like, she does not want to be happy. She doesn't want to be living a good life. She doesn't want to laugh. She doesn't want to enjoy herself while her child is dead. I hope I never have to find that out, but I get it. I get that that's the headspace she's in. And I understand the father too, wanting to bring her out of this by trying to give her what she needs, what she wants, and trying to be playful with her. So they are driving towards a camping destination. And all I'm thinking is like, well, maybe they used to go camping with Maya, and that's why he thinks this will be a good weekend. And maybe that's why she's pushing away even more. Again, I'm doing a lot of guesswork here, but it doesn't really matter because you see it all playing out in front of you. So they get to the camping destination, and then kind of a little bit of fast forward, they just kind of jump to a scene where she's now looking out from the tent. You know how the little tents have that little thing where you can look outside, right? Alma, you're a camp aficionado. You like going camping and all that shit.
I've set up many a tent, and it's not fun. And taking them down is the worst part. It's like everybody's around for putting up the tent, and then you're the one who makes sure that shit gets put away every time. That's enough. I think that's why last time we're just going to get in the cabins because fuck it. I don't want to roll up another tent. I think one time I did like 13 rolling up of tents. Yeah, that's enough. That's enough.
Oh, no. Fuck no. Okay, I couldn't do that. But so, yeah, the mom's looking out and she's like, okay, so you finally hear her say that she wants to go out in peace. So I guess she was kind of like surveying, making sure there aren't any animals or anything out there. And she tries to wake up the dad. And I know I keep calling him dad, but because I don't remember their names. We've discussed this. I'm bad with names. So mom tries to wake up dad, and he's just kind of like, well, go pee. And she's just like, it's kind of a little, their little squabble back and forth. And finally she decides, oh, fuck it, I'm going to go out and pee. So she grabs a flashlight. She goes out there, she has her jacket on, and she goes up, finds a tree, like kind of, she goes quite a bit. No, correction. I wouldn't say she went quite a bit of ways from the camping site, but I'm the type of person that is scared of everything. And when I saw her walking as far as she did, I was like, woman, you are walking way too far away, because I get scared of everything. I get scared of bugs. I get scared of animals. I get scared of reptiles. So she walked way too far for me. She's squatting, she's peeing, and she's taking a really long pee. So I guess she was holding it for a really long time. So anyway, she looks over to the side and she looks at this white cat. There's this white cat staring at her. And I'm like, oh, what a cute kitty cat. But I'm still thinking like, kitty cat way out here? That's kind of weird. Are there like feral cats that live out in the woods? I mean, I know there's feral cats, duh. I see them all the time. But do feral cats live in the woods? Like, feral, like
house I don't cats? Think that's a thing. There, I when I saw it, I assumed there's a house nearby, and that they were on someone else's property. I remember saying out loud, "I think they're on somebody else's property," because I thought it was strange where they were camping.
Okay, maybe that's it then. So she's staring at the white cat, which is actually beautiful, but it was kind of like hauntingly staring at her while she's peeing. And anyways, I would have like avoided eye contact with the cat after that. So while she's staring at the white cat, out of the woods come that trio that we discussed earlier. And like I said, it's that man, the older man wearing all white, this stunning woman. She's very tall, and she just has this presence about her. She's wearing this black, I think it's a black dress, and her hair is like, if you haven't seen the movie, just if you don't want to see the movie, you just want to hear us talk about it, go look at a still of like where they have that trio, and you'll see what I'm talking about, because I'm just loving her. And then that big kind of lumberjack dude, and I forgot to give a trigger warning earlier for this. Oh, I'm very sorry.
Okay. I was waiting for you to bring it up because I'm surprised. I thought you purposely glossed over
it. No, I forgot. I'm sorry. So there is a dead animal in his arms. It's a doggy.
If you go look up the movie on Did the Dog Die? It's the dog. It's dead.
Yeah. But it's a fake dog, okay, guys? It's a fake dog. So just... But he is. He's carrying it around. So it's kind of weird because he's standing there with his, you know, friend in his arms. And then the woman's there and the white dude's there. And then I won't get into detail because they don't show a lot of it anyways, thank goodness. But they begin to assault her out there. And now we see the husband. He's looking on and watching his wife get assaulted by this trio. And I'm just like, what's he doing? Why is he just staring? And I'm like thinking that obviously he's going to jump into action and go and help her, right? Right, Alma? Right? He's going to go help her?
He's going to.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. And then we hear a shot ring out. And so we are left to assume again, because they don't show it. And I'm glad they don't. But they create the scene so that you know this trio are a horrible group of people. And I like that they were able to let us know that without showing us.
Yeah, I like it. If you're going to keep it, if you have a low budget, then you don't need to like toss out stuff that just looks silly, or, you know, a lot of people are watching it to appreciate the movie and we can enjoy it without having to see anything if you can't do it, let's say, well. You know what I mean?
Exactly. So the shot rings out. She passes away, we're guessing. So he's scared. He's hiding in the tent. And then they come over to the tent and kind of fucking with him. And he thinks that he's being like they're not going to find him. They're not going to find him. He's going to be fine. But nope. So now he hears them circling the tent. And now he decides to start looking for a weapon. So we end up seeing him pull out a knife, but it's like, hello, dude. Why couldn't you have done that earlier when you were just watching your wife get assaulted, you fucker? Anyway, so he finally decides to get out a weapon, a knife. And the trio, of course, acknowledge now that they know he's in there. So while all this is going on, I'm feeling really unnerved. Again, I love how they're setting up the mood and the vibe for this movie, because they're extending it, but they're not showing us everything. Cause like they show it from the inside of the tent, him being creeped out and trying to hide and everything. And they're outside. And then we kind of go back and forth. And then when they acknowledge that he's in there, you're like, oh fuck, something's going to happen. And I start feeling really just unnerved, my stomach. You know how, when you start getting like that anxious feeling, that anxiety building up, and the big lumberjack dude, he had a, you know, man's best friend who had passed away that he was holding. Well, he had one that was living next to him too. So he has a cute little doggy that unfortunately he decides to use in a very not nice way. He uses his own dog as a weapon, which pisses me off because I can go on a whole rant about that, but don't use your fucking dogs as your weapon. Protection, yes, but not as a weapon. So he sends his dog in there into the tent, and then the tent collapses and you hear grunting, barking, you know, kind of back and forth. You hear the man grunting, you hear the dog, you know, growling and all that. And then you see just like movement stop, and the trio's like smiling because they're like, oh, good. You know, our doggy took care of our business. And it's like, nope, Unfortunately, the little doggy passed away because his fucking owner decided to be a fucking asshole and use him as a weapon. And the man comes out and the lumberjack guy's pissed that his friend is dead now. And it's like, duh, motherfucker, you put him in a situation that he didn't want to be in. And the other dude had to defend himself. So dude stands up, he's out, he's alive, and they're mad now. They're really mad. It's like, well, what did you guys expect? Now they have this really long, tense, anxiety-filled scene where the woman is holding a gun to the dad, and he is dressed only in his in underwear, and he's standing there. He knows that he's going to die. He watched his wife die. It's his turn now. But they're like really stretching it out. That psychological torture is horrible. And then, boom, he's dead. And I just remember thinking, like, that's the whole fucking movie? What? I know that this movie was 86 minutes long, and it's only like, what? It wasn't even 20 minutes into the movie. And then, boom, they're back in the car. They're back in the car, and they're driving to go camping. So I start thinking, oh, okay. So they're gonna show us what happened leading up to that then. Okay, because you know how sometimes you come to the end of the movie and you see like what, you know, the ending, but it was at the beginning, and then they say, well, this is what led up to it. So, okay, so that's what we're seeing. I'm like, okay, all right. I just remember though, during when this happened, I'm like started getting Dead End vibes. That remember that movie Dead End? I think that's what it's called. Yeah. I really, really love that movie. So I was kind of getting those vibes up from it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I forgot to find out if that was the name of the movie, because every time I think of scenes or movies like that, I always remember that movie because I thought they did it beautifully. But anyway, so they're driving to the camping destination, and Alma even said, oh, is this kind of like Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow? It's like, ooh, maybe, you know, is it, you know, them reliving the same thing over and over? Is it like Sliding Doors where like if you make a decision differently, you know, something different happens? By the way, I love that movie, Sliding Doors. Anyways, if you haven't seen it, look at the movie. It's really, really good. Oh, yeah. And she does a really bad English accent in it. Coming back to the movie. I always do this. I end up going off in the movie. So now we're back to the beginning where they're driving to the camping site. And then all of a sudden we see them at the camping site again. And we're back at that moment where she's looking out and she needs to pee. So it's like, okay, interesting. But it's different. This time when she's waking him up, the fight is a little, the verbal fight that they're having is a little bit more involved. It's a little bit more back and forth. She's like, I'm going to pee in the tent and blah, blah, blah. It's like this back and she doesn't want to go outside, and I don't blame her because it's creepy out there, but I also wouldn't pee in the tent. And that's what she does. She finds a little corner and she pees in the tent. What did she pee in something out or did she just like dig a little hole and pee?
Over the tent cover, they had like a bug cover. I think they called it like a mosquito.
The mosquito net, yeah.
A mosquito net, but it wasn't a net. It's like you usually put like this little extra thing over your tent. It's like a little in-between area where it'll kind of help you get rid of things. And it was their way of trying to keep the mosquitoes out and stuff like that. And she was like in the in-between area. But you're correct. They're still technically where they're, you know, having shelter.
Yeah, so she's peeing, and then the creepy family shows up again. And I was like, it was different, but it looks like the same thing's happening. The creepy family's always going to come. So anyways, unfortunately, again, she gets assaulted. And this time, I think it's worse. And dude, again, her husband does absolutely nothing. He doesn't do shit while his wife is getting assaulted, and then she's dead. So he's left alive for a little bit because they start fucking with him again. I mean, they just love pobrecita attacking her, and they love fucking with him. But it pisses me off because they put her physically through something and they just fuck with his mind and then give him a quick death. That's what I think. I don't know. So boom, he's dead again. And then we're reliving it again. So now we're seeing again, they show up. This is all beforehand. They show up to the camping site. He's over by the lake or the river, whatever the fuck that is. He's brushing his teeth. She's over at the campsite. So each time we're seeing this get played out, we're getting a little bit more what's leading up to the family showing up to attack them. And I'm thinking maybe that part is probably kind of the same, that it's only what happens in the tent that is different, maybe. So anyways, he's brushing his teeth by the water, whatever. And then he comes back to the tent and he's all like, he's horny. he's trying to get some. So he's trying to be silly. He's trying to play around with her, and she ain't having any of that shit. She's like, nope, ain't gonna have that shit.
It's like the Groundhog Day horror movie. This day that just keeps getting worse each time for them, I think. Because, well, I don't think it's going to get worse, but I mean, you can die in worse ways. So she's at the tent window again and needs to go pee. He wakes up this time, startled in a flash, and grabs her and says, "Let's go." This time he's up. Like, he's on his feet. He's not trying to get dressed. He's in his underwear. He's dragging her out of the tent and he's running to his car. He gets it open. He sets off the alarm on it. He could not be any louder. He is like the me of trying to be quiet. Like, in my house, when I am trying to be quiet, I make the most noise possible. I am not quiet at all. The alarm's going off. He's yelling at her, trying to convince her that she needs to get her ass in the fucking car, and she's grabbing her shit. She's grabbing her shit. She's actually grabbing her shit. And I'm watching this movie with Dahlia, and yeah. My daughter has joined me, and the three of us are combined shouting at this lady, "What the fuck are you doing? Do you all not have a ride or die? Do you all not have this covered? You should always have somebody ready to go. You tell your best friend, you call your husband, you call a friend, whoever it is that you call on the damn phone, and you tell them, get in the fucking car.
We know that if I were to call Alma right now, she's many hours away from me. If I were to call her right now and say, Alma, get out of the fucking house, she would do it. She wouldn't ask, what's going on?
Why are we grabbing shit? Yes, why are we grabbing shit? Oh my God, I was losing my fucking mind. Also because we have seen that these people have gotten killed a few times already. Get in the damn car. So we're just losing our shit. Why isn't she moving her ass? So she's grabbing her shit. She's getting, she took too long. Okay. She has no semblance of urgency, none whatsoever. This dude is remembering that he just got murdered. Okay. Because he's up, he's panicked. He knows what's going to happen. And he finally gets her to get in the fucking car and they drive away. Now they're in the car this time. They made it to the car and you're thinking, yes, okay, let's relax. She got her shit, but at least they're getting away. But then she's asking to go pee again. And this is the same day. So obviously we're not changing anything from the day before where she obviously drank too many fluids. She is going to go and pee. She's telling him he's going to have to pull over or she's going to wet herself. So she gets out of the car. And once again, just like Dale mentioned at the beginning of the movie, why is she walking so far? She just needs to pee. Who gives a shit where she goes? She walks into the woods. She's walking and walking, and it could not be further. I have no idea what she's trying to do. Why is she walking so far into the woods just to go pee? And then I think she sees that white cat again. That white cat shows up. And then I think Dahlia mentioned maybe that's the omen of death or something. I remember someone saying that. Here comes the dog. The dog that this trio of slapstick freaking psycho murderers has trained comes running into the woods towards her like an arrow. The fastest running dog I've ever seen comes right at her while she's squatting. And this trio of goofballs are just walking again with this dead dog in their arms. And they approach the vehicle that the guy is sitting in while his wife is getting murdered in the woods. And the guy just knocks on the window and says, "Good day." I wrote down that at the bottom of the screen, they wrote "good morning" in the subtitles, but he says "good day" in plain, perfect English. And she's at the window tent again. So we've restarted the day. And right now at this point, we're like, what the hell is going on? Are they learning anything? What is the point here? Are they supposed to be doing something different? What are they supposed to be trying to do? It's obvious that we've thought this guy needs to save his wife because
that's what I thought. Yeah. Because each time he was a coward. Punk ass bitch each time.
Yes, he was. He was because it kind of seemed like he's just trying to save himself. Okay. It's just at first I thought he was like more in shock. What's going on here? But no, he seemed like this time the only reason he tried to save her was because he realized he wasn't going to be able to get away unless he tried to get her out of there too. So this time they're awake again, except she wakes up to go pee, but the husband's not in the sleeping bag. He's not there. She walks out of their tent and there's snow everywhere. Okay. It's the same kind of dreary looking dawn that we've had in the other scenes where they're waking up and she needs to go to the bathroom. But this time there's snow on the ground. Okay. Another dreary morning. There's snow on the ground. And what do we see in the snow? Thalia pointed this out to me because I was like, what is that? There's footprints in the snow. Okay, sleeping bag is empty. And Dahlia starts saying, this motherfucker took off. And I'm like, no, he didn't leave.
He fucking drove away, left her there.
Yeah, she's following the footprints and there's car tracks. I'm like, those aren't car tracks. I'm still in denial here, okay?
You really are.
And Dahlia's like, no, he's fucking gone. He's gone. This guy took off in the damn car. And he left her. He left her. This time he's like, okay, I'm not even going to try to save her this time. I'm just going to get away. He only drove the fuck away. This motherfucker got up in quiet. Okay. He fucking snuck out of the tent with the keys. Like, can you imagine the little cat burglar getting up in the night, kind of tiptoeing away from the damn tent? In the dark and getting what the fuck was going on in this guy's head. Okay. He got out of the tent.
I picture him getting out. Like, you know, if you've ever fallen asleep with a child in the bed and they fall asleep and you're trying to get out without them noticing that.
Oh my God.
And you do all of a sudden your body can contort itself in weird ways and you're trying not to move them. That's what I'm picturing.
Slid out of there. And I thought this was at least smart. This time she wasn't picking up anything to take with her. She grabbed a sleeping bag and I thought, okay, I'm going to let her grab that sleeping bag because it's fucking snowing and cold. She's probably going to wrap herself around it and hit the road, right? So she grabs that sleeping bag and she starts heading off in the direction of the track because that's the road. She gets on the road and as she's looking ahead, you can see what was there? Because Dahlia saw it first. She had way better vision in this movie. I was
the lights, the what do they call the tail lights of the car? It looked like the car had crashed.
Yes, and I didn't see that, and I don't know why I wasn't seeing shit. But Dahlia said the car's crashed, and we were both kind of like cheering, right? Because it was like, fuck yeah, you crashed, you tried to get away like some steely little burglar, some fucker, and you crash. And so she starts like picking up the pace. She gets up to the car and she's obviously panicked and freaked out here because this guy ditched her for a reason. Like, why the fuck did he leave? But she looks in the vehicle and it's empty. There's like a rock in it. We thought it was like a tree stump or something. Something crashed through the window. It's irrelevant. She's taking out debris from the tree he's crashed into, but he's nowhere in sight. And she's like, but you know what? I'm going to get in this fucking car. I'm going to get in this car and I'm going to drive away because regardless, he took off. I don't really think she was as much concerned with the fact that she couldn't see him as she was concerned about why did he leave and what the fuck is going on here. So she gets behind the wheel and she starts to try to move the car, but it's stuck. So she gets out of the car and she's trying to move it herself. And she's just like completely like losing her mind. And that cat shows up again. Dahlia's omen of death. It showed up. We're like, oh no, what's going on? And we think that trio is coming up, but it doesn't show up. It's just a cat. And the cat is cute. And she takes the time to pet the kitty, you know, and it calms her down a little bit. And she starts following the cat into the woods. And I'm kind of screaming, don't follow the damn cat. Don't follow it. But she's following it.
It's kind of like she's in a trance when she's following it. She's just like,
yeah,
she's not reacting. She's not doing anything. She's just following it. They just set up the mood so perfectly. And you just watch her and you're seeing her walk. Like, it looks like a very long ways because they change up the scene a little bit. So it's not like she just walked, like, you know, to the backyard or something. She's walking and following for a long time.
Yeah, it's a trick. Dahlia notices that the woman looks a little bit different in stature. And I think even like a little bit more hunched over.
A little heavier. Because, this is why, okay? So they're showing her from the back the whole time. They show her from the back walking, okay? But earlier in the movie, when this poor woman gets assaulted, I remember seeing her legs, and she's a very thin woman. While she's walking in the woods, this woman looks heavier. It was a different body type than the woman I saw earlier. And you just see, like then Alma said, you know, a little bit more hunched over and everything. This is a completely different woman walking in the woods. What's going on? In my brain, I'm thinking, oh, stunt woman, something's going to happen. You know, all this, you know, this muscly woman's going to, like, I don't know, just like pick up a tree or something. I have no idea, but that's what my brain's thinking.
So when she's approaching a kind of small house in the woods where we're all like, don't go in there. Of course, don't go in there. Don't go near that house. The cat's leading you to your death. That's when they turn the camera around so that you can see the woman's face. And she's an older woman. It's obviously supposed to be the same woman, but we can tell now that she's aged. That's why they were showing like the long walk. This is a trek. Like I mentioned, this was like a journey this woman went on, and she's now a noticeably older woman approaching this creepy house.
And I think it's kind of like what Alma said in the beginning of the movie, that it doesn't have a huge budget, this movie. And so they use that to their advantage when they create these scenes to put, you know, to create a mood. But with this woman, that long trek, they were able to, because, you know, a lot of movies, they'll just put makeup and prosthetics and all that shit on someone to make them look old. And this movie's like, nope, we're not going to do that shit. We're going to get a different woman and we're going to show her aging while she's walking. So I mean, you don't actually literally see her aging, but that's how they use they use the time that they had so that they can create that semblance of her aging.
And they're doing it well. It's like, sometimes let's just let the movie take us where it's going. Just follow along. Just like this lady, obviously this movie has a lot of metaphorical meaning, obviously, but sometimes just watch it. Okay. This is an older woman. Now some time has passed and she's approaching this cabin, this house in the woods. And she goes in, which we know you should never do, everyone. We know this from watching all the scary horror movies that we've seen. You don't go into the house, but she does it. She feels at peace. And I think I felt that while she was walking. This woman was finding a peace. It's like an inner peace because she looked tired. She was exhausted. She's older. And she goes in and there's a little box on the floor, a crate that she sits on. And there's a puppet theater set up. In the beginning of the movie, there was like a little puppet show.
It's a shadow play.
Oh, a shadow play. There you go. Like a shadow play. And when she sits down, there's some big red curtains and they open up and we're seeing a shadow play now of two little bunnies, very cute. And in the foreground appears the shapes of a couple of our killer trio. They've shown up, but they're moving the parts in the shadow play. There's two bunnies. They have a smaller bunny. And there's a rooster, which I thought was a turkey, but obviously it's from the nursery rhyme. It's supposed to be a rooster. And it shows what has happened. It shows what has happened. These two parents lost and they get angry. And what do they do when they lose their child? They lash out and they start lashing out at anything and everything. But you know that that's not going to help the situation. Okay. She's watching this and it shows the parents, and all this is doing is dividing them. Just like we've established, it's been 3 years and they're trying to go on this trip, but the parents, they're splitting up. They're just moving further apart from each other. And this play is like a representation of that.
I just want to give at this part, Alma, before you go on, I want to give kudos to this actress. She doesn't say a damn word, but you feel everything. The power of that moment from the one, she doesn't really, her face doesn't even really change. She doesn't, she doesn't move a lot. She doesn't, you know, her face, she isn't talking. Her face doesn't make a lot of expression, but her eyes, the way she has this look on her face, you can feel the fatigue in her bones. You could see her eyes. They're teary. She's tired. She's been crying. You could feel all of that. And this woman is just sitting there, and I love her.
Especially looking at her eyes, it's like the exhaustion. She's watching this, the shadow play, and the little characters, they've caught the rooster, they've caged it, there's a fire, and it's the end. It's the end of something, and it's supposed to be, I think she gets it. She gets it. This is their marriage. This is them failing. This is the end. The two little bunnies, they go off. It just, you can see it right on the screen. And then she's young again. She's young again. And they're both back in the tent. Okay. This time she's putting on her shoes. He wakes up startled and drags her out of the tent. He's dragging her out of the tent. This time he's going to do it right. He tried to take off without her the time before. He's dragging her towards the car and he's yelling at her and he's not giving her an explanation. I don't think we've established, we don't really need to, but she is fighting him. She gets away and she runs back into the tent and we're like, oh, hell no. Hell no. She's not trying to get back in the fucking tent to grab her shit. And he shows up at the tent and he's assaulting her. And that we're really not sure how he's assaulting her, right, Thalia? I think we were just like, he is hitting her, but they're not really showing it. But you can tell that he's fucking assaulting her in that tent or on that tent. And he drags her ass back into the car. And then they're in the car again. They're in the car. This time you look towards her and they show her pants. She's wet herself. He obviously did not stop this time for her to pee. And you're thinking, okay, he let her piss her pants. She's got it, but she looks terrified. She looks horrified, and he looks a little bit more at peace. He looks at peace like, I got her. I got her in the car. This time, we're not fucking around. We're not fucking around. We're on the road. We're doing this. But then out of nowhere, something runs across the road. And this is where we see it. They hit that dog that the man was carrying in the beginning of the movie, that he's been carrying this whole time. It was the dog. They hit that dog and they end up crashing off to the side of the road into like a little creek on the side or whatever. But when they crash, they're both looking at each other like, we're alive. We made it. We made it. They still have that moment of relief. Like he looks even more relieved. He looks even more relieved because he sees her alive. They've just survived this very near-death experience. And so does she. She looks like relieved. And not only that, she looks a little happy. And they hugged. They hugged. Like they just went through this thing, this new thing, and they've made it. Now, that's just where the movie ends. That's where the movie ends, with them two in the car on the side of the road, crashed. Is this the beginning all over again? That dog that they hit? Or is this them moving on? Like they've had their moment and they've made it and they're going to continue on.
And I love that because the camera pans out and then you're just seeing it's you're getting a wider view of the countryside around them and everything. And the whole time I'm thinking, okay, where's the family? Where's the family? You know, but we don't see the family. It ends. It ends there as it's widening out and you're seeing the countryside and the car just getting smaller and smaller. And I love that ending. I even wrote down. I love that ending because it's like, you don't know what's going to happen. Is their marriage going to survive? Are they going to survive? You see that? See what we're doing there? There's hope now. There's hope. And I said earlier that all the metaphor in this movie, I loved it. I loved this movie. And then we start hearing the nursery rhyme again. And this is the funny part, because when we start hearing the nursery rhyme, we had just watched the shadow play, right? Like really, really recently. And then it fucking hit me. Rooster. Oh, cock-a-doodle-doo. Cock-a-dee-cock-a-da. It reminded me of when we watched The Wicker Man and I was like, remember he says Daniel? He says Daniel? And I was like, oh shit, he said Daniel. So it was like one of those moments where I felt like a complete asshat.
this movie, of course, it's draw what you want to into it. It can just be watch it and it's some sort of just psychological thriller Groundhog Day situation, or just let it go where it takes you. It was enjoyable. It was different. I like what they did with what they had. And at the end, it was like, hey, it's a different take. It was a story of hope. It was a story of the end, but then they found their way back from the end together. They were supposed to do it together. Thank you very much for participating in our poll and having us watch this film. Dahlia, were you able to find us a real world connection this week?
I did. So I started going down this rabbit hole. See what I did there? But I thought, oh, let me do something with nursery rhymes. Because, you know, like a whole bunch of nursery rhymes are actually like the story of something really fucking morbid that's happening during that time that nursery rhyme was made, right? Like London Bridge, everything, Ring Around the Rosie,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, they're not good.
No, they're not. So I decided I was going to go in that direction. And when I started doing some reading, I saw, you know, remember the song Frère Jacques? It's Frère Jacques.
Yes.
Frère Jacques.
I'll sing it for everyone. No, I won't.
Well, again, I don't know if we can sing it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think we can. I think nursery rhymes are one of those things. But I don't want to fuck with it. Okay.
You can't sing Happy Birthday. Someone still has the right to that. They didn't even sing it in this movie when they sang Happy Birthday to the little girl. They had their own version.
I thought it was just because they were in another country. So, yeah, I found this thing. It's from a journal article. Oh, shoot. I forgot the name of the journal article, but I'm going to link it in the description. I think it was like a urologist journal article, something like that. It's from a medical journal. And I just thought it was really funny. I'll tell you why in a second. But the title of it is called Frère Jacques Beaulieu from Rogue Lithotomist to Nursery Rhyme Character. And I'm like, what? Frère Jacques is based on a lithotomist from back in the day. I thought that was really interesting. All right. So of course I'm going to click on it. So this article is by Jacques P. Ganem and Coley C. Carson. So Frère Jacques Beaulieu was a celebrated 17th century French lithotomist. And a lithotomist is just a fancy word for a person who took your kidney stones out. So Beaulieu was born in 1651 to a peasant family and learned the practice of lithotomy by apprenticeship. He was never formally ordained, yet he donned a monk habit and called himself Frère Jacques. He was the first person to use the lateral approach to perineal lithotomy and openly shared his surgical technique. I love reading all these fancy words that I have no idea what they mean. So he openly shared his surgical technique that he used. His lithotomy procedure was observed by the High Court in Paris on three separate occasions. Like, how does a High Court observe the surgery in 1697 and 1704? It's not like today, like they can like fucking zoom in or shit like that. No, this is like, you know, it was like you had little, to travel and do stuff. And then
the little operating rooms were not really operating rooms. They're little theaters where anybody could come watch. And who knows what soap's for? Hey, let's burn shit that we should be washing away with clean water. That's why.
So, yeah. So the High Court in Paris observes three of his procedures. Unfortunately, his patients had significant morbidity and mortality, and he was denied operating privileges. He was known for this method, yet so many of his patients were dying. Okay. He performed approximately 5,000 lithotomies in 30 years, and then he died in 1719 at the age of 68. 5,000 lithotomies. Now, you're probably thinking like now in today's standards, like a surgeon performing that many, first of all, that is a lot, but maybe you're thinking like, oh, okay, we know this kind of surgery, blah, blah, with the technology we have. Okay, that's possible in 30 years. No, this was back in the fucking day when they didn't have any fucking kind of general anesthesia. And, you know, people had to travel to have the surgery. He either had to go there, people had to come to him. It was a completely different way of doing shit. So 5,030 fucking years, you're going to hear in a minute why though, why he was able to perform so many in 30 years. So like I said, he died when he was 68 years old, and the nursery rhyme Frère Jacques probably refers instead of to him. Yeah, he called himself Frère Jacques. However, it probably refers to a playful group of, I don't even know how to pronounce this word, Jacobinic monks who often oversleep. Yeah, so it wasn't about Frère Jacques, the lithotomist. It was probably most likely about a playful group of monks who often overslept. Okay, I'm reading from the abstract of this article, and that's why it's hilarious, because remember the title is called Frère Jacques Beaulieu, From Rogue Lithotomist to Nursery Rhyme Character, right? That's what sucked me in. It was fucking clickbait but you know what? I don't know if I can call it clickbait, because in the abstract, they fucking say, we found no direct association between Frère Jacques Beaulieu and the nursery rhyme character. And I still clicked on it. I still clicked on it. Probably mostly because, you know, I wanted to find out more about these 5,000 lithotomies and all that bullshit. So yeah, fucking academics suckered me in. I'm going to read a few more excerpts from this article again, just because I find it fascinating. I just love this shit. And you know me in research. So here we go. The practice of lithotomy dates back to antiquity and was described by virtually every society, including the ancient Greeks, Egyptians, Chinese, Persians, and Hindus. This procedure was the removal of calculi, essentially a kidney stone, from the kidneys, bladder, or urethra via the perineum. Did anyone else's anus just pucker? Because my anus just puckered. I'll keep going. So the Hippocratic Oath, you know, that was developed sometime in the 5th century BCC, clearly separated physicians from surgeons with the statement, this is like hoity-toity right here, I will not cut, indeed not even sufferers from stone, and I will keep apart from men engaging in this practice. Hey, what the fuck does, I mean, really? Okay, so yeah, this concept laid the groundwork for the evolution of lithotomists and barber surgeons. Barber surgeons, shit, we could go off on another tangent on that one, but we're gonna rein it in and just keep it to lithotomy. So furthermore, surgical procedures were not encouraged during the medieval ages and were considered pagan ritual. Surgery was considered a fucking pagan ritual? This is fucked up. I hope I did not have a past life in that time period. So the fact that they thought that surgery was pagan ritual, this allowed untrained persons to perform lithotomies, and the practice flourished as untrained and poorly trained people took on this practice. So remember this, people, that regardless of whether physicians or surgeons or so-called professionals that were trying to separate themselves from everybody else, whether they wanted to perform these lithotomies or not, they were still needed. Today, even, some people still need. They're a medically necessary procedure. Because physicians and trained surgeons wanted to differentiate themselves, the hierarchy that they created actually allowed for lithotomies to be dangerously performed on people. So I'm going to go back to the article. I'm going to read directly from it. During this time, Jacques de Beaulieu was born to a poor peasant family in Burgundy, France in 1651. He dreamed of leaving his monotonous life and pursuing a career in medicine, but joined the cavalry as a private at age 16. At age 21, he was apprenticed by a wandering Italian lithotomist and hernia surgeon named Palomi. I love that it says wandering.
He's wandering.
So yeah, this dude was named Paoloni, and he taught Beaulieu the trade of lithotomy for about 6 years. So he apprenticed with this dude for about 6 years. Beaulieu then went out on his own and practiced lithotomy in Provence for 10 years. In about 1690, Beaulieu experienced a personal mystical event that changed his life. Now, this article doesn't mention it. I read through the whole thing. It's probably because this is like a fucking medical journal. So if you're interested, go find out what happened to Beaulieu in 1690. So a personal mystical event that changed his life. Without formal ordination, he donned a monk habit and called himself Frère Jacques and lived a simple life dedicated to his profession and improving the human condition. Frère Jacques asked only for nominal fees for his service, devoted his life to charity, and often distributed his earnings to the poor. He roamed the French countryside, as a lithotomist and had an excellent reputation. Oh, so it sounds like this guy's pretty cool, right? Like, I mean, Beaulieu, you hear Beaulieu's in town. It's like, oh shit, I had this kidney stone. I'm going to go over there. And he doesn't even want that much money. And then the little bit of money that he gets, he's going to give it to the fucking poor, right? This dude sounds amazing. His technique was to place the patient who was restrained by several strong men, since there was no anesthesia, remember people, in the lithotomy position. You guys know, if you don't know what the lithotomy position is, just think they don't really do them like this really anymore, but like the gynecological examinations and the stirrups, that's what it is. So he would put people there. People would hold, strong men would hold that person down, and he cleaned, listen to this, he fucking cleaned his instruments and his hands in the oil of roses. In the oil of roses. This is what you said earlier, Alma. That's like they're not using, oh my God, soap and water, alcohol. Obviously, they didn't have it. They didn't have it. I mean, they did have it, but we didn't know the science of it. So this is what he's doing. He's opening up people's bodies and he's using instruments. Now, these are instruments that are not autoclaved. They're not professionally cleaned or anything afterwards. They're dipped in the oil of roses. All right. So I'm not going to read the description of how he performs the surgery because it's pretty intense. But if you're interested in it, again, click on the article from the description and it'll tell you exactly what he does. And if your anus was not puckered before, it's going to be puckered now when you read this description. Anyways, back to the article. After he performed the fucking surgery, he would declare, I have cut the stone out of him. God will now heal him. God will now heal him. Frère Jacques did not use dressings and he left the post-operative treatment to the family of the patient. He rarely, if ever, saw his patient after the procedure and was often criticized for this neglect. So he fucking cut them open and he didn't do shit to them afterwards, said God's going to heal them, and then left the poor family to take care of them afterwards. So his track record then was obviously abysmal and many of his patients died. He blamed it. This motherfucker had the gall. He had the fucking gall to blame it on other monks or other physicians or surgeons saying that they poisoned his patients so that they could die. I mean, think about that.
I love that this has turned into a true crime medical history story. No, I'm serious. It's like this is one of our first serial killers, like for real.
But yeah, and he's using God as the reason like for all of this. So anyway, so going back to the article, autopsies found that significant complications such as urinary fistulas, bowel and bladder injuries, uterine and vaginal damage, urinary incontinence, I can never say that word, but you know, when you can't hold your pee, excessive bleeding, infection, and scrotal gangrene. Oh my God, this all sounds so, I don't have a scrotum and it hurts me right now. It is estimated that more than half of the mortalities were attributed to transection of the internal, I can never pronounce medical words, pudendal artery, the pudendal artery. It's basically, it's the artery that supplies blood to the perineum, skin and muscles of the anal and urogenital region, rectum and erectile bodies of external genitalia. So he fucking cut that shit. So all that blood and infection was invited to that region. And of course, you know that we didn't bathe back in the day. We didn't fucking, so that area is such a breeding ground for infection and bacteria and all that. So these people never had a fucking chance with him. All right. Right. So that's really interesting, right? So what does any of that have to do with the nursery rhyme Frère Jacques? So I'm bringing it back. Okay. So the article says this French round, again, I love rounds, was written for the harpsichord during the 17th century by an unknown author. Is it a coincidence that Frère Jacques Baudelaire lived during the century, or are these two separate individuals? One interpretation of the nursery rhyme is based on the lifestyle of, again, can't pronounce this word, the Jacobinic? There you go, Jacobinic monks. I said it. So it's based on the lifestyle of those monks who lived adjacent to the St. Charles Cathedral in Paris. The name Jacques is derived from the Latin Jacobus, which means comfortable and soft. These monks pampered themselves and their guests with rich foods and soups and played card games late into the evening. They often overslept, and thus one interpretation of the song is a polite mockery of their lazy lifestyle. Oh my God, I love that. I fucking love that I learned that. So anyways, so what's the verdict? This article found no direct association between Frère Jacques Baudelaire and the nursery rhyme character. And there you have it. You learned a little bit about lithotomy, about this man who killed all these people, and, you know, about these fucking monks that apparently like to oversleep.
That's our horror history lesson for the day. And if you need anything else to be traumatized by, go look up why the chainsaw was invented. Or maybe Dahlia. I can tell you a little bit about that on another episode.
Okay. All right. Again, I'm going to link this in the, I'm telling you guys, it's not a very long journal article. So don't think that it's going to be long and have all this stuff that's going to bore you. No, it's thoroughly interesting throughout. So before we wrap things up here, I just want to say real quick, if you are on Clubhouse, go join the club. Let's Chat Horror. It's not my club, but I am a member. I love it. It's a really great group. Right now, it's a smaller, more intimate group, and it is really interesting. It's March 28th, so that way you know if you're listening to this podcast much later. Right now, March 28th, they have scheduled rooms Wednesdays and Saturdays, and I think it's Saturdays where they have a theme. A couple of weeks ago, I joined in on the room when they were discussing diversity. The rooms have themes sometimes. And this one was called Women of Color Representation. And it was such a fucking interesting conversation because Alma and I had been talking about this, how there's just like very little representation of BIPOC, women of color, anything like that, especially in horror. I mean, we just don't see it. If you want to find a brown person, it's either going to be a trope of some sort or it's going to be a foreign movie. Right? Because like when we saw that really awesome movie, La Llorona, that was a Guatemalan movie. So again, this was a really great conversation. There was even a director, writer, producer that was in on that conversation talking about it. So again, Let's Chat Horror on Clubhouse if you're on Clubhouse. And that's it.
So I think this means that is going to leave me with choosing the movie that we watch for next week's episode. We have a big long list that we keep of the movies we've watched, the movies we haven't seen, the movies we've seen and would like to cover on our show. And I thought, what about we do a movie that is intended for kids? What do you think, Dahlia?
I love that idea.
Because Dahlia brought up on one of our Instagram posts a couple of weeks ago, what are some movies or books or interesting horror tales for kids or something you read when you were a kid? And there was a post about it. And then I made a reel of my top five kids horror picks. So it's on our list to watch. I don't think Dahlia's watched it. It is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Ooh, I remember the book.
Yes. So I was going to say, a lot of you I know are familiar with the book because we read these over and over when we were a kid. First of all, Dahlia and I used to go to the library all the time and we check out anything that was a scary story, haunted story, or anything to do with aliens. We love that shit.
The Bermuda Triangle.
I was terrified of the Bermuda Triangle. Why do people keep flying in there? I think I even put that on a post one time. Anyway, that was a book we loved. There's Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Read it if you haven't. It's really fun. And then there's a Scary Story to Tell in the Dark too. I think I still have those books unless I donated them to the last book drive. But they made a movie. It's actually PG-13. They don't really show anything that you know, as adults, we wouldn't care. But I actually took one of my kids to go see. She didn't like it. And she's a spooky kid. And it's weird because she has a nickname that I won't say on here.
Yeah.
Because she likes creepy shit.
she's creepy. I love it.
So it was strange that she didn't. And I told her, you know what? Do you remember the book? And she was like, I love the book because we read them. I would tell the kids, like, sit around. Let's have a scary story time. And they loved it. But anyway, so I thought it'd be fun to watch.
Yeah.
And then we can cover it. But definitely still not a podcast for kids, only because, you know, we can't recommend people listening. We cuss a lot. It just happens.
I cuss way too much.
It's life.
I mean, my kids are used to it, you know.
And they can listen to it if they want, but you know, that's up to the parents. We have to say it's up to the parents if they listen to it. But watch it with someone, okay? The recommendation is PG-13. There's no blood, no gore, anything like that. It's just mostly for spooky, intense situations. And of course, there's death in it, but you know, that goes for horror movies, all right?
All right, Alma, so lovely conversation today. I wish we could keep on going, but we've been doing this thing where our episodes are so long because we keep talking, but we're talking about really interesting stuff and we just, yeah. So we're going to cut it right now. We're going to stop, I promise. And Alma, if people want to get a hold of us, they want to email us, they want to look at our pretty pictures, your reel, where can they get a hold of us?
You all can email us at nightmaremoviepodcast@gmail.com. Or hit up our Instagram at Nightmare Movie Podcast.
There you have it, everyone. You know how to get a hold of us. And we'll see you guys next week with
Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Thank you, everybody. Until next time.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Nightmare on Fifth Street, a horror movie podcast. If you like what you heard, don't forget to follow and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Also, leave a review or share what movie you would like us to discuss. As always, thank you for listening.